Hey everyone, I'm Jordan from New St. Andrews College. I'd like to invite you to join us for one of our upcoming prospective student weekends. We have one on March 2nd and 3rd, and another from April 13th to 16th. To learn more and to register your visit, check us out online at nsa.edu. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This afternoon is a faculty panel. Mr. Escalante will be the referee moderating between the two heavyweights. Intellectual heavyweights. Dr. Gordon Wilson and Pastor Douglas Wilson will be discussing together, and I'm sure Mr. Escalante will not hold back in putting his opinion forth as well, on Christian care for the environment and how that should or shouldn't look. So I'd like you to give a warm welcome to our faculty panel.
You two know each other, right? He's brought the Bible.
I have brought the sword.
All right, so as Dr. Edwards said, we're going to be discussing the environment today, and mostly these two will be. I'll be moderating and occasionally maybe suggesting a distinction or two. But the statement that we have to work with is this: care for the environment is a Christian responsibility based upon, one, a theology of creation and the command to subdue the earth. Two, the commandment to love one's neighbor. Three, the future promise that all creation is being reconciled to its creator. I think these are general principles. I don't really expect any disagreement between the two of you on these. I'd be a little alarmed if that were the case. Might have to be a different disputatio. There's a fourth point where I think some disagreement might arise, maybe not, but this is what we're going to explore. And this has to do with the application of these principles. And this last clause is, there should, however, be the requirement of craft competence in caring for the environment and a need to reject the sufficiency of good intentions, right? And I think actually both will agree on that statement. The question is how that's going to be practically interpreted. So why don't we go ahead and start with Pastor Wilson, who's already grabbed his microphone in preparation, and then we'll go back and forth.
At the principial level, we all agree, I'm sure. The question comes down to the particulars, and the question is, who's the idiot? Who doesn't, not up here. So when you say craft competence is necessary, if you're going to take care of the environment, you actually have to actually take care of the environment. It's not enough to say, the parable of the Good Samaritan says you should take care of the guy who's beat up by the side of the road, and you should do your best to get him to the inn and give the innkeeper a couple of coins, and that's all good. But if you break the guy's neck moving him, then the parable becomes a different issue. The point of the parable becomes a different issue. So I wanted to just say, lay my cards on the table, roll my cards, and then we can take it from there. I'll begin by saying I grew up in Annapolis, Maryland. I remember as a small kid, in the summer evenings, mosquito trucks would drive through all the neighborhoods, and it was, for all the children of the neighborhood, it was almost as good as the Good Humor Man, the ice cream man, because clouds of DDT were spewing out of the back of these trucks up and down the neighborhoods, and the game was for all the neighborhood children to cluster and run after the truck in the cloud, and you won by holding your, who could stay in there the longest, and So perhaps I'm revealing more about my environmental sensitivities than I want to. That was a different era. Oh, that we could get back there. If we got back there where we could still use DDT, millions of people in Africa would not now be dead. Right? So, the first Earth Day happened almost 50 years ago now, and I participated in the first one, sad to say, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Of course, we should care for the environment, of course. But those who care for it should be competent and judicious and not at all like the current enviro establishment types. The predictive track record of environmentalists is comparable to Hal Lindsey after 6 or 7 beers. It's just one unmitigated miss after another. So consider, just within the last generation, within my lifetime, consider global cooling. In the 1970s, global cooling was going to kill us all. Global cooling was the thing. Also, Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb, the prediction of overpopulation, we're all going to die because of overpopulation. There were predictions, solemn predictions of mass starvation. India now is an exporter, the world's 7th largest exporter of agricultural goods, but there were predictions of mass starvation. There were predictions of resource depletion. We're going to run out of minerals, et cetera. There were predictions of mass extinctions. There were predictions of positive predictions about renewable energy that never actually showed up. Renewable energy is a great idea. And then, of course, the most recent frenzy is global warming. So if we agree that we need to take care of the environment, we need to be good stewards, we can sign off on all those principles. But when we go to actually take care of the environment, overwhelmingly the environmentalist establishment needs to have absolutely nothing to do with it because they don't know what they're doing. They are partisans, they are agitators, they are looking for the main chance, they are getting a lot of money this way. I just think, could we please have environmentalism without any environmentalists?
Well, I don't disagree with much there. I don't want to define my position based on what environmentalists are doing or not doing. My goal is to figure out a biblical conservation ethic that is not reacting against environmentalism. Many Christians will either react, say, "Oh, it's cool to be green," and so they'll just drink the Kool-Aid and get really fuzzy thinking about just being green in so many ways that is very similar to the current secular environmentalists. And then we have the reactionaries that say those kooks, they are messing everything up, and if they like it, it must be bad. Now, I know you're not saying that.
Pave the planet.
Pave the planet. If those guys hug trees, let's hate them. There's this redneck reaction that, and I'm using that in one sense, where the Billy Bob sort of person that says, "Well, the environmentalists care about that stupid endangered species. Next time I see it, I'm going to run it over," kind of thing. That mentality is nonsense. I think they do make a hash of a lot of, like you were saying, they've predicted a lot of things miserably. But in some cases, as you would, just an example, if you have the choice between learning guitar from a rank pagan like Eric Clapton, who plays the guitar well.
This is a trap.
He knows more about guitars than many Christian musicians, and so it would be good to learn a thing or two from someone whose craft is that. There are many wild and wild-eyed environmentalists that are, Gaia worshipers, and they don't think clearly on things, but they're many of them are level-headed ecologists. Many non-Christian ecologists know a lot about ecology in the sense of more of the in the trenches, how to bring certain things back from extinction. And they are doing a whole lot more work in pulling creatures back from extinction than many.
How do you separate those two classes?
Well, the thing is, I think we're so busy reacting against environmentalists that we're not getting in, rolling up our sleeves.
I would argue that in the environmentalist establishment in the current climate, it's irregular to compare the establishment PhDs who are, let's say, in the global warming.
And camp, I'm not disagreeing on the global warming.
Versus the redneck who is going to, kill the lizard or kill the owl when he gets a chance. Because you've got educated versus uneducated. The real comparison you want to make is between educated and educated, which you'd want is a scholarly debate, the environmental extremists will not allow. So if there's anybody who's educated in the establishment, some environmentalist, responsible, level-headed guy, the guy you describe, and I believe that they're out there, I also believe that they run the risk of losing their jobs if they say anything.
Right.
Right? So what we are in a highly politicized... if I found out that my next-door neighbor was a secularist who knew a lot about ecology and the environment, he was a sane, level-headed guy, I wouldn't have any problem taking lessons from him over the back fence. Mm-hmm. But I would know better than to put his job and his livelihood at risk by talking about any of this in public.
Right.
Right. In other words, the environmentalists have made it impossible for us to discuss these things publicly to come to some sort of solution. And so consequently, you're just going to get redneck reactionaries.
I feel like we need to get
there's more than one talking, distinction that needs to be made.
Yeah, we did.
Well, there's different kinds of rednecks for starters.
Yeah. That's for sure.
Well, I think going along with what Pastor Doug just said, I do think that it's kind of an invidious comparison to compare the PhD holding environmentalist to this hypothetical, and I've never met one, the hypothetical Billy Bob.
I've met some.
Who says, I've heard about this environmentalist thing, so I just want to burn it all down because of those darn environmentalists. It seems to me like the real discussion is between environmentalists, and even there you'd want to sort of say, well, who is that environmental establishment actually? Versus the people they're concerned about, which is what I think you would call the world of crony capitalism, which has its own interests and puts a lot of money into its own research to sort of fund its conclusions, right? Those are the two big titans on the stage, it seems to me. And they sort of know it about each other, right? Those are the two that really deal with each other. I'd want to hear more about who this environmentalist establishment is, though. I mean, how do we... I think you yourself already got to that question by saying, how do we distinguish these people out from, Dr. Wilson's responsible ecologist? They're an ecologist, he sees certain things, makes conjectures. And one more distinction I'd want to I think we should work with is when we're talking about a track record of failed prophecy, we do want to ask... Did those prophecies not come to pass because people acted in response to the alarm and then modified the trajectory of causes, right? So, I mean, I wouldn't want to say, the Hebrew prophets have a really bad record for preaching and actually getting people to convert and avoid the thing that they prophesied, right? So it seems like if those distinctions are on the table, it seems like we could go further with this.
I'd like to get more specific. I want a prompt that's more specific.
I didn't write this prompt.
So I'll give.
I would like something. I want to get into the nitty gritty and not these nebulous.
So when Al Gore says all responsible scientists agree that, that's who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. All right. So you've got Gore, who has no claim to the Nobel Prize or whatever it was he got.
He invented the internet.
We should not get me started.
That was a claim that he made.
So when Al Gore says all responsible scientists, it's a no true Scotsman fallacy, right? All responsible scientists are the ones who agree with this position, and if you are the lone, just the invidious name climate denier, mm-hmm. you know, climate change denier. What is that meant to make you think of? That's meant to make you think of Holocaust denier, mm-hmm. lone crank. So you're a climate denier. Mm-hmm. If you say, I've got some questions about what CO2 actually does, mm-hmm. right? And I've got some scientists here who also have questions, and they'd love to raise them if they didn't lose their jobs. So basically, that's who I'm talking about, mm-hmm. the established state university system, the all the approved types, the cool kids. That's who I'm talking about. And if we had a situation where you could have them and other scientists who disagreed and businessmen, corporations, the corporations you're talking about, have an actual discussion, that could be fruitful. But once the government gets involved, what you're doing is you're talking about coercion, right? Mm-hmm. So all of the things I talked about, the proposals were, we're all going to die because of starvation, and therefore the government should.
Right.
And everything always ends in coercion.
Right.
And if it ends in coercion, I'm against it already.
I am too. And that's why
How
I
about
want.
You, Peter, are you against?
And this
would
is
depend on the case.
That's why these. I mean, those prompts were okay in the general, but I feel like we agree in principle. What we need to talk about is when you have top-down coercion by the government. They're saying this is the way it's happening. What I want to see is instead of us reacting and saying, well, since those guys are all wet, those guys are all wrong, we can just ignore what they say and then go on our merry way. There's a lot of problems that need to be addressed. The government's wrongheaded on a lot of it. Some of it is a real problem. There are not mass extinctions, but there's a constant attrition. There's a constant trickle of things going out. I'm not saying we need to look at the secular government and figure out what I'm against top-down command and control. I want grassroots. The grassroots to solve all the environmental problems is the gospel, and you would agree with that. You change the heart of man first. And then when you reconcile man to the creator, then you then mankind begins to think about the creation as something that God made, and therefore something that they value. And instead of always positioning themselves against what the seculars are saying, we need to proactively take the helm. Now, if we can't take the helm at the state level, we don't need to, because then we would just be in this top-down command and control. When you legislate top-down, you put it on a chafing public, and when a chafing public doesn't care diddly about the legislation, they go on and do what they want. So gospel first. Then it changes man's perspective on the environment, and then they begin to solve it, whether it's at the non-government, you know, level.
But there's an important fork in the road. Let's say we assume Reformation and Revival. There's a massive turning mm-hmm. to Christ.
Right.
People get their hearts right all across America. Then what? Well,
right.
there's some Christians who say, well, then we'd be in a position to make safe, sane, responsible environmental laws.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then there would be others, and this would be the way I would take it, say with these conversions, people turning to Christ, people would then be in a position to exercise wise dominion with their own personal property. Mm-hmm. Right? In other words, I don't want coercion on these issues unless you can show that you're dumping toxic chemicals in the river 100 yards upstream from my house, mm-hmm. and you can show the detrimental, demonstrate the detrimental impact. I want to address environmental concerns through market mechanisms. Market mechanisms are not going to do any good if everybody's a pagan and they're in it for themselves.
Right.
But if you have free men, free grace, free men, free markets, which is the way it goes. Right. Free grace, free men, free markets. No. As a result of free markets, when people have their own private property that they take responsibility for and that they take stewardship over, nobody wants to drink dirty water as opposed to clean water.
Or breathe dirty air.
Nobody wants to live in a brown world as opposed to a green world. And as wealth increases, people don't want to live in a pigsty. You know?
Right. But there's a way of, and this is good because there's a way of still maintaining a pleasant environment, but being completely unaware of the actual lavish diversity that God has given us. Many people who aren't in biology don't. They'd be happy if there's cows and sheep and goats and corn and wheat and rice and all the things that can keep me moving because they're food items or clothing items. That's great. But God made a world that's so much more lavish. And private property, I'm all for. But we also need to, as we are reconciled to God, the layperson, not just the biologist, needs to realize how amazingly rich and lavish the world is. And we don't raise cotton top tamarinds and pygmy marmosets for meat, okay? Nor do we raise them for hide. They are, as Peter Lighthart said in, it says, liberal arts are useless in the same way that a centerpiece is useless, the same way that salt and pepper are useless. Most of the things on this planet, in terms of utilitarian use to our livelihood, are useless. Millions of species are useless, and God made them. And when he said, and I don't think you think they're, I don't think you want to make them all go extinct. I'm just saying that.
It depends. Whose are they?
But a lot of people might have this rich. For example, on a lot of big tracts of land, if you privatize all of it, would you, let's say Yellowstone, you say, well, let's privatize it, give it to the, as a trust, give it to the Sierra Club.
I'd prefer to give it to the Nature Conservancy.
Or Nature Conservancy. I would want to give it to someone who knows what's out there and say, and so keep it as a trust.
Well, just as a rancher wants a large tract of land to raise cattle, and different people use their land for different interests. Some people use their money to become engineers. Some people use their money to get training to become a concert violinist. Mm-hmm. Some people do practical things. Some people do the Peter Lighthart useless liberal arts impractical thing, right? Which enriches our lives.
Right. Everything makes life rich and wonderful.
So if you want that exotic lizard to survive, mm-hmm. then persuade others to get a Kickstarter. that's a different campaign.
I think you could get, if you put that on your back, you could probably get a lot of money.
So
well,
I have to finish the point. Here, right. He was being cute, just like Christopher Hitchens used to be. So what happens is, if you want to save that exotic lizard, get people, like-minded people, raise the money, and buy a huge tract of land, and set it apart for that purpose,
mm-hmm.
right? Do it without coercion.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm arguing, because there's a vast difference between people voluntarily buying up a tract of land to preserve the beauty of it or the mm-hmm. ecological systems that are contained there, and someone coming to a rancher's ranch and saying, hey, you can't buy any more cattle.
And I agree. If it's a private property, they can do what they want. And that's why I want grassroots. The gospel needs to do more than just, okay, I'm saved, but we, rather than coercion, say, listen, you've got all of this land, you've got all sorts of things besides cattle and grass, but you've got everything that you need. But as we gain in knowledge of the world that God has given us through a grassroots sort of way, to have private owners begin to realize, hey, there's a lot more out there than what I need for my pocketbook.
That's because environmental groups don't come to ranchers or businessmen and say, what you're doing is wonderful, we support it, we hope you make all
right.
the money in the world, and we would like to solve a problem by giving you some extra free information. We want to save
yeah.
that lizard on your property.
Right.
Can we help you out by giving you something
right.
rather than what happens now,
yeah.
which is always we want to
yeah.
take, demand.
I agree.
And that's how the...
I don't like the take, demand.
Let me ask a couple clarifying questions. So Pastor Doug, earlier you said, well, the question is, whose are they,
yeah.
right?
Right.
And you both are talking a lot about private owners. But Scripture, we do have that book over there somewhere, does pretty clearly teach that the earth actually belongs to the Lord, right? It is his. He
right.
made it. I take it that Dr. Wilson's idea is that he owns not just the land that he made, but all the things he made on it, and he's put us in a position of stewardship. So we don't actually have kind of an absolute right of disposal, right? We couldn't...
Correct.
If it were in our power to get up into the satellite and press the button and blow the planet to pieces, like in that first Star Wars, right, when Darth Vader makes poor Princess Leia watch the planet get blown up, we don't get to do that, right?
Correct.
And it seems to me what Dr. Wilson is saying...
More agreement.
We're in agreement, I know. So what Dr. Wilson is saying is that there's some obligation on anyone, whether they know it or not, whether they are Christian and acknowledge it or not, there's still a divine obligation to preserve the basics of what God has planted in any given place, not to leave it, you know, sort of whatever imaginary pristine state, but to preserve the basics within which humans would then live and cultivate it as a garden, right? You have to work with, to cultivate a garden, you take what's there and you prune it and shape it, and some things will have to, you know, some peripheral things will have to go, but if we're talking about, and you're not talking about, you know, paving Montana, I think was the original joke. Do we have, though, do we agree on this, that the earth actually belongs to God? And
yeah,
that we're
because it says so in the book.
It does. He did bring the book. And then what does that, what, how does that cash out for us ethically, kind of prudentially? What obligations are on us? Or does this remain kind of a stratospheric, sort of abstract thing that somehow he owns it, but basically if we completely trash the place while he's gone, he'll say, well, you know, I wasn't paying
you
attention.
You did it inadvertently. You made all sorts of things go extinct. But you didn't have malice aforethought. You were just doing your thing, making money and lots of things, collateral damage. And I think that's where we need to
But the problem is, I think this is the boy that cried wolf scenario.
Mm-hmm.
My entire adult life, environmentalists have been telling me we have 5 years left before it's all over, and they've been doing this again and again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't believe them at all anymore.
Okay,
I just don't believe them. So goodbye. See you.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you very much.
But let me ask this question though: would we all agree that humans are capable of dramatically transforming the environment for the worst?
And both ways, yes. For the better and for the worst. We really did kill all the passenger pigeons.
Yes, we really did, and we almost killed all the buffalo, at least here on this continent, and almost took out the snowy egret. But let me just say that we've talked a little bit about private property, and I'm all for it. I'm also realizing your legitimate rampage against the environmentalists and all of that. I think they've done a horrible, they've caused a big reaction in a bad way, and they've been heavy-handed in a lot of their attempts at public policy, because they've just been trying to impose their legislation on a chafing public, and I don't like that. But in terms of the private property thing, so many things just don't lend themselves very much to private property. You've got a lot of things that are commons, things that, for example, in Psalm, this is what I love. He's talking about cultivated areas with domesticated animals. He makes grass grow for the cattle, plants for man to cultivate. But it also says in verse 17 of Psalm 104, the trees of the Lord are well watered, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. There the birds make their nests until they're, yeah. Well, the stork has its home in the pine trees. And then in verse 18, I love this. I love this. Listen up. The high mountains belong to the wild goats. Not every square inch of the planet is meant to be arable. The high mountains belong to the wild goats, the ibexes, the things that, and we sometimes think so utilitarian, like, how can I, you know, get my cattle on that vertical slope? Well, too bad. God made it impracticable for your attempts. Now, I'm all for grass to grow for your cattle, plants for man to cultivate. I went to the University of Idaho in the College of Agriculture, and I love that. But there is certain areas, the crags are a refuge for the conies. There's so much of this land. You'd say, well, some of it, you know, can be cultivated. Should we, you know, where do you draw the line? And I would say that I don't want to impose saying, no, don't. What I want to do is cause people through just my classes or even the documentary, is to cause people to see the world with new eyes so that they go, oh, I didn't know that was out there. I just thought it was just a handful of animals so I can eat them. And there's so much more out there. And a lot of those things just don't have utilitarian purposes. Sure. And so I think what we need to do, and here's a provocative statement. I think it is corporate folly. I don't call it a sin. I would say it's
corporations or collective corporate.
It is collective folly and a symptom of sin, not necessarily the sin itself. It is a symptom of sin when things go extinct.
Sure.
Okay.
But the question is, who's sin? How do you spread it? Whose responsibility? And until we stop having our reflex action being the state.
Right. Rather than complaining about the state, I would say we need to get out there and be faithful as Christians with the gospel so that
when the North American buffalo almost went extinct, that was a government program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when you have three kids and three straws and one chocolate shake, what are the incentives that are built in? The incentives are to get as much as you can, and then when the glass is empty, you move on. Mm-hmm. Right? The thing that is missing is responsibility, stewardship. The very thing that's missing is stewardship.
Right.
Now, I agree that the Alps were not given to us by God so that we could grow corn there. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things that I'm glad are preserved. I'm glad they're set aside. I'm glad I'm glad in principle for the conservation, sometimes for the sake of beauty, sometimes for the sake of the preservation of an ecosystem that's rare and, as far as we can tell, useless. All of that's true. But when Yellowstone almost burned down
because
a generation ago, it was because it was a government program. Mm-hmm. Right? It was a government-run operation.
But also the government has learned from their mistakes, and so even
the government never learns from their mistakes. Never.
There's an old school forestry and a new school forestry. The old school forestry was just treated as a monoculture, so they treated timber like it was cornfield, and they would just have a 40-year rotation. And then the new school forestry is treating the forest for wood. They want to harvest timber. But they're treating it, they've learned from the mistakes, and they're treating it as whole ecosystem. So I agree that a lot of times they don't learn from their mistakes, but that's probably an overstatement. They don't always get things wrong. I've learned a lot.
But I know where my betting money goes.
I've learned a lot from how ecosystems work from textbooks that come from state schools. It doesn't mean that that's what the policy is. I think the people that are heavy-handed in the government often don't have a very nuanced view of what's going on, what's actually in the books. They just say, because this is one thing I learned in public policy, is that the government wants one-handed scientists. Because most scientists will say, on the one hand this, but on the other hand this. They somewhat have a nuanced view of things. But the government says, I don't want two-handed scientists. I want a one-handed scientist. I want you to give me the bottom line. And so what they do is they just bottom line it on one side. They don't have a nuanced view. And then the government takes that one hand and runs with it in a very, very bad way.
And this is maybe an important point of agreement. In his wonderful book, The Vision of the Anointed, Thomas Sowell compares the conservative mentality with the liberal progressive mentality. And he says conservatives tend to think reflexively in terms of trade-offs. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, on the other hand. Mm-hmm. Liberals tend to think in terms of solutions. Mm-hmm. They want a solution for this.
Right.
Conservatives say, well, if you solve for this, you're going to cause this over here. It's a trade-off, right? Mm-hmm. People are saying, we have air pollution. Back in the 70s, the air pollution was really bad, and it was bad because of car exhaust. And so we're going to mandate, because if air pollution continues this way, people are going to die. They're going to get emphysema decades from now. And so we're going to mandate that everybody now has to drive a little tiny crumple car made of little thin aluminum, so they get a lot of gas mileage, better gas mileage, and now they all die in...
Not if everybody was driving around in them.
Well, I'll put it this way.
Just kidding.
I'll put it... it's a trade-off. You can't just look at what the DDT might do in Africa... because of the side effects of DDT, you have to look at what the malaria does in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's the conservatives think in terms of trade-offs. So whenever we suppress one thing, something it comes out somewhere else. There's some other aspect of this mm-hmm. that we need to consider. And so responsible science really does say it's more nuanced than that. We've got to be careful on the one hand, on the other hand. That's what conservative policymakers also say. It's not that simple.
Scientists might say that, and some conservative thinkers might say that. I don't think all policymakers who would be called conservative can be counted on to have sort of a Burkean sort of checks and balances point of view. I mean, many of them are themselves deeply indebted to corporate interests who are just as interested in solutions, right? If the progressivists want bits of utopia bit by bit, which is why they like the solution, right? Like, how can we get closer to the absolute state of political perfection? You've got crony capitalism on the other side pushing for short-term solutions to maximize their
gains. But we get rid of crony capitalism.
Which is I
call crapitalism. Right. You get rid of that by getting the government out of it, because as soon as the free market is there, the business owner is invested. He's got skin in the game, and he has to think in terms of trade-offs. He must, or go out of business. The only way you can safely ignore trade-offs is if you have some coercive power bailing you out. And nullifying the costs of your mistakes. So I want to see the markets brought to as much of the environment as you can.
Right? So at markets, just one question, markets do depend upon information on anybody's account, right? Even if the Austrian economists say, this is why markets are better, is because they deal with information better than a centralized state system can.
But not one person with that information. The information is diffused through the system.
So North Africa was desertified, in part by goats, right, by people, being pastoral, having goats. Do you think that that's something that was an effect that could have been foreseen and avoided kind of in a market framework by all those little individual landholders, and could you count on their self-interest to arrive at a market solution for that? Or if you had some person in late antiquity who was, it's hard to imagine a late antique ecologist, but let's say he existed, and he saw the effect that the goats were having by pulling things up completely by the roots, and he said to the magistrate, let's say it's a Christian magistrate, hey, Christian magistrate, the goats are causing a problem, and I don't think that we can count on all of the little landholders to act on this information, because they don't all have it at the big picture level. How would you solve that problem? If we took you back in the time machine, right, we gave you some sandals, we let you loose in late antique North Africa, the magistrate's going to listen to you.
Hippies wear sandals.
I'm sure there are photographs, Doug, but what would you do?
So what I believe a wise king would do, if he saw people behaving in a counterproductive, destructive way, what a wise king would do is he'd say, we need missionaries and teachers. We need, and he would issue an invitation or a call to the church to send in missionaries, send in teachers, establish schools. Because if the people are converted, if the people are converted, that doesn't mean they will know what to do. But if they're converted, they will want to know what to do,
right?
because they will prefer a green place to a sandy place.
Right.
They will know to prefer that. And so I think you have to bring the gospel first and educate second.
Right.
But I think the education can't be part of the problem. So it has to be an invitation. The magistrate should issue an invitation, a call to evangelize this place.
Right.
And where the gospel has gone over the course of centuries, it's not something you can take in 5-year increments,
right,
but where the gospel has gone, things have gotten progressively greener, mm-hmm, actually greener, not greener in propaganda.
You can even look from a satellite image between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, mm-hmm, and see that one half is green and the other half is brown.
Right.
Because governments have a huge impact on whether
it's like Ahab and Jezebel. They bring in the gods of fertility and to make Israel green, and they turn it brown.
And that's the another wonderful passage. Is a lot of times we look at just the physical cause effect of a particular environmental problem. That's why I totally amen the gospel, because in Hosea, a wonderful passage in Hosea, that's always finding a minor prophet is tricky. There's Hosea 4, it really talks about the ultimate cause of environmental problems. The thing is, the Bible doesn't use the word environment. It uses the word land. It uses the word creation. But we need to realize that we can, there are synonyms, the creation, the environment. But when we use the word environment, we think, oh, that's just the realm, or that's the domain of liberal, secular wackos. But it's the earth, and it's the Lord's. And he said, hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There, and then here's all the problems. There's no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery. They break all bounds. So all of this is just sin, 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 sin. They break all bounds. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. And then in verse 3, because of this, the land mourns. And all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea are dying. So what is the cause of the environmental problems? Well, not to put too fine a point on it, sin. And the solution to sin is the gospel. When you reconcile people to the God of all creation, then you begin to, those people that are saved and reconciled to the Creator will begin to think, well, if I love the Creator, now I want to love and I want to care for that which the Creator made. And so that's, yeah, I'm totally with my brother on the government is going to make a hash of it. They're going to impose top-down, silly, silly policies, trying to solve a problem and making it worse most of the time. And we need to not only just teach them the gospel, but educate them so that we learn regenerative agriculture, where we say not just, okay, it's okay to graze your sheep, but let's graze your sheep in such a way that you can have your generationally, the land is built up rather than diminished. So more and more of education, but all under the Lordship of Christ.
I wanted to circle back around to Peter's point that he raised about the absolute sovereignty, the ownership of God over all things. God owns the world. The earth is the Lord's. That is true, but we, for every square foot on this planet somewhere, we have to figure out who is the deputy, who's the steward for this spot, mm-hmm. who is the steward of the, you know, who's...
And if you don't, you have tragedy of the commons.
Right. Yeah, basically, if you if nobody's responsible for the whales, then it's the three kids and the three straws, right? Mm-hmm. They just go after the whales. So somebody's got to be responsible for them. I believe that governmental statist responsibility is problematic. A, in our day, the state is an idol. Two, it is an idol that generates increased devotion the more it fails. So it's like the priests of Baal dancing around the altar. The more Baal doesn't answer, the more they dance and the more they cut themselves. And I don't think we should be looking to statist solutions at all. It sounds funny and odd to say, well, could we have whale farmers, you know, great whale dairies or something. Mm-hmm.
I don't think you'd like the milk.
I don't think I'd like the milk, but I think people at the shop at the co-op would. Yeah.
Yeah. It comes out almost like yogurt.
So, that Doug, if...
See, I'm upset that you even know that.
So if the mountains belong to the ibex, right?
Yeah.
And let's say someone just wants to go poach all the ibex, wipe them out. Whose responsibility is it then? Because according to Scripture Gordon's got, none of us really have direct jurisdiction over, or all do, but no one of us has private property jurisdiction over things that are remote from
like
humanity.
Like the Pacific.
My proposal, I made this proposal 3 or 4 decades ago, and that is I do believe in conservation. I do believe in beautiful spots being set aside. I don't have any problem with ecological protections being set aside. But what I don't want is the state running it. Mm-hmm. Because my father-in-law was a pilot. He took a command in the Air Force one time, and he this illustrates a lot of things. There was an outpost that a plane from his base flew up, and they supplied them like once a week. And so he thought, I'm in command of this place. I think I'll fly up there and see what's going on up there. So he hopped on the plane. They flew up with the supplies to this little outpost. And he so what are you guys doing up here? Well, it turns out that their job up there was to unload the plane. That was what they did. So their job was to unload the plane, and the plane flew them supplies once a week, and it was just a nothing, just a bunch of nothing for nothing. That's the kind of thing you're going to get. Mm-hmm. If I've made the joke before, if I were president,
it would be a lovely 2 days.
And what a glorious 3 days that would be. I give myself 3 days.
Of three, sorry.
3 days. But if I could wave a wand and have the problems fixed, the national parks would no longer be the state property. They wouldn't be the property of individual states. What I'd want to do is have a law passed where conservation organizations could own this land in perpetuity with right. a charge.
With so a, they'd be a trust.
A trust. Yeah. They would have a trust, and they would be allowed to extract minerals or to log or to do responsible work. They wouldn't be permitted, obviously, to clear cut, strip mine, or do anything like that. But they'd say you can benefit your organization financially by harvesting certain things from this land, but your central charge is to preserve the beauty of this spot or preserve these involved ecological systems and so forth. I'd want private trusts given that commission by the state.
How do you, it's now state land, how do you, or the federal land, how do you decide who to entrust it to of all of these NGOs?
That's where crony capitalism comes in.
He already said he likes a nature conservancy.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're at 403. Seems like these two are in general agreement, and it would take longer to go further as we ought to some other time into the details. But let's open it up for questions from the audience. No, Mr. Wieske, that was very fast.
Okay.
That was suspiciously fast. Okay, you.
Christians will generally... Oh, thank you. That Christians will want to take care of the environment. That's right. All well and good. But isn't the purpose of government to use coercion to make up for the lack of good heart that lots of men that don't believe the gospel and that never will have? So an unbeliever who is unregenerate and never will turn to the Lord needs force to keep him from actually damaging
Correct.
The world more,
yeah.
doesn't he?
I don't have a problem at all with coercion. And I don't have a problem with the magistrate using coercion for murderers, rapists, kidnappers, thieves,
poachers.
Poachers? Well, poachers. If you're stealing someone else's animals, but you can't just say, "I don't want the government coercing anybody for sins that they have defined as sins, crimes." If the government makes up the crime and then punishes for the crime, I've got a big problem with that. I think that the government ought to be strictly limited in the Christian's mind to applying coercion only where a black letter biblical case can be made for that coercion. So if someone is a rapist or a murderer, I'd have no problem with coercion. Coerce away with a capital C. But if you're wanting to coerce an apple farmer because he uses a particular kind of pesticide that in 500 years might make some neighboring animals on your, a little sick, right? And somebody speculated this, and they have a computer modeling system that says that might happen. I don't want coercion to be within any kind of reach of that kind of scenario.
But you'd be fine with coercion if he's using something, some substance that is advantageous to him but is demonstrably disadvantageous to his neighbor?
Absolutely. So if someone is using chemicals in his plant upstream that is polluting in destructive and damaging ways the water that I have as much a right to use as he does, then yes, I should be able to get damages.
Just good tort law.
I should be able to recoup my damages from him with the magistrate as the referee. Yeah.
Okay, who's
Michael Helvey here?
Hurry, Cooper, hurry.
So both of you talked a lot about kind of the importance of thinking about these things in terms of private property. What do we do in cases where it's very difficult to discern what effect something could have on others' private property? For example, like what if someone is pumping gas into the atmosphere from their 2,000-acre estate in South Dakota or whatever? They're not affecting any of their neighbors, but nevertheless, they're changing the atmosphere in a way that could be detrimental to the planet.
Might be beneficial. Maybe we should be paying them.
Perhaps.
But if we don't know, we don't know.
Yeah, but my question is, if it is demonstrably bad, then, but it's not demonstrably hurting other people's private property.
I mean, near them. Wasn't that your original point?
Near them, right. But it would obviously damage everyone's private property in the future. If that was demonstrable, how do we deal with situations like that?
Well, a lot of things with the air, it's the commons, and that's where it gets into, it's a little bit more difficult. Like, would you say, I was just asking you, would you say that the Clean Air Act, there was obviously a problem. There was way too much air pollution back in the late 60s, 70s. That Clean Air Act made it demonstrably better after that. Would you have what would your solution be that's more of a...
I'm grateful for the clean air, and I remember how it used to be. I'm grateful for the clean air, but I believe that we made something... It's trade-offs, not solutions. Mm-hmm. We made something clean by making something else threatening and dirty. So what happened is we had the EPA... Mm-hmm. So we used to have dirty air, now we have clean air, but now we have a dirty EPA and a politicized EPA. Mm-hmm. And when I was building my house, I had 3 acres out there, and I had, this was a serious problem. We had a wet spring one time, and there was a puddle on the lower acre, and a duck kept landing on it. And I didn't want that duck... I was in a vulnerable position where someone could have come in and declared my property a wetlands because the duck landed in the puddle. And so I would rather breathe free than freely. So I would I'd rather be a free man in dirty air than a slave in clean air. And what we did is we traded one for the other. And
well, what would be the solution where you stay free and you get clean air?
Basically, I believe that as the standard of living rose in North America, people don't like dirty air, and there, right. I think there would have been market solutions. As it happened, the environmental solution that was applied there, the Clean Air Act, did solve that one problem, mm-hmm. right? And thank God, and I'm grateful for it. But I still want to think in terms of trade-offs. Mm-hmm. If going back to the question, if someone does something... I believe that we speculate far too rapidly and wildly about things that are bad. We pronounce them bad before the science is in, particularly if it's way down the road. So I don't want to do anything unless and until someone in a court of law with cross-examination can show damages. Mm-hmm. When someone can show damages, I believe they should be able to recover those damages, but I think they have to prove it. What I'm doing is okay unless someone proves, according to biblical standards of evidence, that it was harmful to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm innocent until they prove that.
Let me ask then a question to clarify some of this. I don't take it you would say that the air itself could be divvied up into private property.
No, God has assigned. There are certain places where God has made it necessary for us to deal with the problem of the commons.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so, like, air and water would be one of them.
Air and water
and
would be,
maybe yeah. ecosystems on a big scale, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. I'm comfortable with that.
And whose jurisdiction is that politically, if there is such a thing?
Well, like bird migrations, you got birds migrating from Europe to Africa, and if they say nest in one person's private land, and then that person totally destroys their one nesting site, you know, it's not just air and water that's flowing and has no respect for property boundaries. Lots of animals travel, and so
are they in the realm of divinely ordained commons, like biblical law. Mosaic law doesn't talk about water rights at all. Right? Mm-hmm. So that was a huge problem coming west. How do we sort out upstream, downstream issues? That's the problem of the commons. The atmospheric issues are a problem of the commons, and so on. I would like the state in those situations not to function as a manager, but rather as a traffic cop. Mm-hmm. You know, I would like us to agree on certain principles, but not regulations for... Right. But principles, and then the magistrate functions as a traffic cop, sorting things out, not as a regulator who can come in and make you do things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have time, I think, for a couple more questions. Will Boyd in the back.
Who would keep the? I got a quick question. Sorry.
Who would keep the
private trust?
You
do, from,
Cooper. Okay.
Who would keep the private trust from being strip mined by whoever's in charge of it?
If a trust has certain protections built into the trust document, then what happens is if they violate the trust, then and the trust is established on behalf of the American people, then an action can be brought for violation of the terms of the trust. I would want teeth in the trust endowment.
Will Boyd.
Yeah, I got a couple statements and then a question or two. I'll try to be concise. I think first, it'd be great to hop down from 30,000 feet. We didn't quite get to the subtopic of how can we love our neighbor, which I'm really interested in. I think we have to stop making a caricature of our neighbors, and we can't leave enviros out if we are to love them, first statement. Second one, we can't take dominion from the couch. And then a couple questions. And these are challenges. I'm sorry, Gordon.
What was that last?
The second one was we can't take dominion from the couch. We have to get our hands in the garden. We have to be out there. Just a general
statement.
We can
take dominion of the couch.
We can. And we should take dominion of the couch. But zooming back out, I just wanted to make those couple of comments as an encouragement for the students here especially to go out there and get involved and love your neighbor. Because there are people out there who need to hear the gospel, and you can plant trees right next to them and quote scripture all the while. This is for Doug. Two questions. Does the government get in the way of you digging deep into God's words? And then my guess is you're going to say no.
They're trying.
Why does it let you get in the way of understanding and caring for God's creation? And the reason I'm asking the question that way is because I keep hearing the government as the straw man from 30,000 feet. But there's so much happening on the ground that a lot of these blanket statements that you've made today could be disproven in a lot of different cases. For example, all the extreme enviros, there's no groups that are actually working with landowners. Those are false statements. There's a lot happening out there that you're not aware of.
Oh no, I'm aware of groups that work with landowners, right? I'm just saying that the people who show up in the newspapers, the people who show up in the media, the people who show up in as part of Al Gore's entourage, the people who speak the officially approved truths, in their book, landowners, private business owners, private citizens are the bad guys. And I'm not saying there's no cooperation between people with environmental concerns and people with private property or business concerns. When Nancy and I built our house, before we built our house, the first thing we did was plant trees. I believe that we ought to be actively engaged in making the world around us, where to whatever extent that we have dominion, we should be engaged in making it beautiful. That's our responsibility. And I'm not opposed at all to anybody who, without coercion, is working together with others to achieve that result. I think that part is glorious. I just don't want them to call themselves environmentalists, because that associates them in the public mind with the people who have destroyed their testimony with all these false prophecies that I began with.
And that's actually our time. I got you got two statements and two questions, so I feel like that's a quota. So we're at 4:16, and let's thank our panelists.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about, because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously, because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.